This is Andy Speary, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 29th of January 2013. Andy Speary, Part 1.
Andrew George Speary, and I was born in Chippenham on the 11th of January 1954.
So you are now 58?
59. I was 59 the other day.
59. You're now 59. Mm. Yeah, okay. Did you come from an educated family? Was your dad a professional man? Or?
My father was an engineer. He was actually a fellow of the Institute of Plant Engineers, and he'd had considerable steam experience, and particularly steam generating experience. He worked for many years for Nestlé as chief engineer of their factories and other things as well. But he was a professional engineer, and he had his seagoing chief engineer's ticket.
Oh, right. Did he ever go to sea?
Oh, yes. He spent all the war years in the Navy and worked his way up to, the position of chief engine room artificer, which was basically the bloke that ran the engine room. And in those days, you couldn't make the leap from being an artificer to being an officer. You couldn't go there. So because the Navy was so short of engineers at the end of the war, certain engineers they approached and wanted them to stay on. And part of the deal was that my father sat his chief engineer's ticket and became an officer, which he duly did.
What was his name?
Martin.
Okay. So did any of that kind of come back into the home? Did he have model engines at home? Or?
Oh, yeah. My father was a very, very keen model engineer, but also restored... He knew a lot about steam cars, and he restored steam cars for people, all manner of things. Anything to do with steam, really, my father was keen. At one time in my teenage years, we had a traction engine, which we used to rally. Going back from that, my grandfather and my great-grandfather were agricultural engineers, or agricultural and general engineers. It's a bit of a genetic problem, really.
Well, my next question was, did any of this rub off on you?
Yeah, unfortunately it did.
In quite a big way.
Well, I suppose so. I don't really know. It's difficult to be objective about it yourself, isn't it? But I've never done anything else. And I can't really conceive ever doing anything else. So I suppose it has, yeah.
Did he serve an apprenticeship anywhere?
Or? I did, yeah. I actually served an apprenticeship at the company that my grandfather sold in 1947. My grandfather retired in 1947, partly due to ill health, sold it to some people, and I did my apprenticeship there. I started there in, I believe it was August the 3rd, 1970.
What was the name of the company?
Maundrells.
Maundrells?
Yes, and my mother was a Maundrell. So they kept the name of the business because the company had such a good name that they kept the name.
Did they specialise?
Not really. In my grandfather's day, they called themselves engineers, iron founders, and millwrights, which pretty much encompasses anything you want to do, really. but by the time I went along, they were basically agricultural engineers and tractor dealers.
Right.
And I served my apprenticeship as a tractor mechanic.
What happened at the end of the apprenticeship?
I left because we couldn't agree on the money. The chap who'd been the tractor mechanic had left, and I had carried on in my late apprenticeship. I just carried on and picked it up and done everything that this other chap had ever done. And I wanted to pay him for it. And they didn't want to pay me for it. So an agricultural contractor heard through a friend of mine that I might be interested in having a change. And I think Maundrell's paid me £24 a week in 1974, and Michael Bell, the contractor, offered me 40. So not a lot of thinking needed to go into that.
That was in this country, though?
Oh, yeah.
But you went abroad at some point?
Yeah, I worked for Michael for a few years, and then went to New Zealand travelling, working on farms, repairing machinery, all sorts of things, and had a great time, and in many respects probably should have stayed there, but didn't. I came home in April, May of 78, and decided, well, I was looking for something else, you know, I wasn't ready to settle down, so I was just looking for something else.
Did you, if you work on the land or on equipment that manages the land, did you find yourself forming a kind of a relationship with the land? Did you, if you come from a long line of agriculturally minded people?
Well, we come from a very long line on both sides of the family of principally farmers.
You mentioned the Doomsday Book.
Yeah,
on
my mother's side, the Maundrell side, they are mentioned in the Doomsday Book as farming at Calston.
Which is where?
Calston's over on the Downs, closer to Calne. And they're still there.
In Wiltshire? Here in Wiltshire?
They're still in Calston.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable, really. Can't be many families that are in the same place now as they were in Doomsday Book. They just haven't moved.
Nearly 1,000 years.
Yeah, long, long time. Long, long time. So, yes, I suppose you're right. Yes, it does. It makes a difference to me.
Can you put your finger on that?
That's hard, really.
Give me an idea.
Very hard. I suppose you could best say, really, I'm a man of the open spaces. I like open spaces. I love the Wiltshire Downs, the Salisbury Plain. I love the chalk, and wouldn't ever want to live away from it. I mean, living down in the Vale here is about as close as you can get to living in the chalk. But I don't know. I like the rolling hills and the open spaces.
How do you feel about deserts?
Well, I've worked in a few of them. I don't. Very similar, really. Very similar. Just at the moment, with all the rain we've had, I just think living in a desert could be really great. But, a similar...
feel.
A similar feel. You know, you've... space. It's a question of space.
Okay. Now, the Antarctic fits into that description, doesn't it, rather neatly?
Hardly fits into it extremely well.
Yeah. What's your first... can you remember your first kind of awareness that there might be a place on this planet called the Antarctic?
I was always good at geography at school. I've always been interested in geography, in places, in people. One of the few subjects I was actually any bloody good at, really. But I had a reasonable awareness of things. From a schoolboy, really. Probably my first real awareness of the existence of British Antarctic Survey was Maundrell's were dealers for International Harvester tractors and machinery.
Ah, okay.
And from time to time, International used to send round a company newspaper. I've got a copy upstairs of a 1967 one of when International Harvester through Cripps at Leeds sold BAS 3 crawlers. So I knew that BAS operated international crawlers. And then in about 1972 or 3 or so, or something like that, when they lost one of the crawlers down a crevasse at Halley, and it was recovered, and then subsequently they just put a pair of batteries on it, started it up and drove it home. And it was a great story. And an international harvester for the Smithfield show that year made a big play of this. You know, you could leave this thing in a deep freeze for 3 years and put a batch on it and it would start and drive. And I remember thinking, well, you know, that's quite impressive, really. But you know, I never really thought more about it until a friend of mine happened to spot an advert in one of the newspapers.
For Bass.
Yeah. Looking for tractor mechanics.
But had you read about the Heroes at all?
Spot? Not at that time, no.
No.
No, that came later. No, I was obviously aware of Scott.
It was that black and white film, wasn't it, that you probably saw as a teenager on a Sunday afternoon when you should have been doing your homework.
Yeah, that's right. No, I was aware of Scott, probably less so of Shackleton. Definitely aware of Scott. Yeah, I mean, every schoolboy really has been taught about Scott, haven't they?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So what made you respond to this advert rather than just put it to one side and say...
Well, I wanted to go. I wanted to travel. I wanted to do things. And a friend of mine, farmer over near Cowan, he was the same. He'd been in Australia and wasn't ready to settle down. And he jokingly said one day, he showed me the newspaper and said, go on, you want to have a go at that? So anyway, I did. I wrote to them and duly received a reply saying, you know, acknowledgement. But nothing really happened. And Rob was also looking around for something to do. And we both, my friend Rob Hislop, the chap who showed me the advert. Cut a long story short, we both applied to Massey Ferguson as overseas technicians supporting MF principally in Africa. We, funnily enough, we both went for interview at the same time, same day. So we went up to London together to Massey Ferguson's international offices and, and were duly interviewed. Both of us were offered a job. And anyway, Rob took his. Rob went to Mozambique for a while. That was probably that would I think probably have been before the Civil War. And then Julie got shipped off to Nigeria. Massey Ferguson were somewhat indistinct about where they wanted to send me. It could have been Libya, could have been Lesotho, or Saudi Arabia. And I said, well, I mean, they weren't offering fantastic money. In fact, the money was pretty rubbish, really. But it was a fact of going somewhere, you know, that's what it was all about. And they knew that, so they priced the job accordingly. And anyway, I said, well, look, you know, I'll go to Saudi for the money, and I will go to Lesotho for the money. But if you think I'm going to Libya for what you're offering, you know, the answer was no.
What was your reasoning there?
Libya was bloody unsafe. I mean, in those days, Gaddafi was in his prime, you know, and you had to watch yourself. So I sort of vacillated a bit about it, and during the vacillation, Caris Williams rang me up, and we're getting into October now. So she rang me up and said, oh, we've got a little bit behind with the interviewing. Are you still interested? I said, yes, I am still interested. She said, can you pop up next Tuesday or whenever it was? Yeah, it was just a few days' notice. And I said, yeah, that'll be all right. And I went up there. And I remember distinctly being interviewed by Eric Salmon, Dad, and John Hall.
Yours. Okay.
Yeah, John Hall. And, it was a very, very fleeting arrangement, really. I mean, I don't think Dad said more than half a dozen words, but nothing new there. And I bet most of the time it was either Eric or John Hall talking, you know, and asking questions. And anyway, The interview came to an end. Didn't seem to take 5 minutes, but it came to an end. And John took me out of the room and said, look, go and sit over there. One of the ladies will bring you a cup of tea. And we'll come back and talk. So literally by the time the tea came, John Hall came back out again. Right, he said, if you want it, the job's yours.
Right. So there are several factors at play here, I suspect. Were you the only candidate that day?
Yes.
Do you think that something had gone wrong somewhere?
I think I know what happened, but I'm not absolutely sure. So,
what do you suspect?
Well, no, I don't really know. I think somebody that was going to go down in that capacity probably went in another one.
Right.
I don't really want to go into names and details because I don't actually know.
Okay.
So enough. Rather than speculate, yes, I think there was a change around. I think that there were factors that weren't immediately obvious. I mean, now thinking back on it, 30 years ago or more, you could probably see a pattern, but at that time I didn't know. So John Hall said, right, he said, yeah, we'll give you five minutes to think about it. And I said, no, I don't really need 5 minutes, John. Yeah, that's fine, I'll take the job. Right, he said, we better come and kick you out, because Bransfield had long sailed. She'd gone, and he remembered he took me down to the clothing store, issued all my kit into
bloody great kit.
There and then.
This still story, just to interrupt briefly, this also suggests that the job was yours unless you fouled it up.
That's right,
isn't it?
Well, I suppose probably. I mean, it was in some respects for them, it was a heaven sent, because there was an international harvester trained an experienced mechanic going to look after their bulldozers. You know, it was probably a chance that they probably couldn't turn down. I mean, yeah. I don't know if anybody else is being interviewed that day. I do know Tony Escott, the electrician. Tony, I think, went for interview the same day. I think Tony went the same day. So it was all running very, very late.
Yeah.
But of course, Tony went to Rothera. That was much easier to get in and out of.
So you went downstairs to the store to be kicked out,
and was kitted out with all this gear. And
did they give it to you to take away, or did they just arrange to have it sent south for you? You don't have to remember.
I honestly can't remember that, but do you know, I got an idea. I might have taken it with me. I think I probably did. I had a big old Bedford van in those days, and I think we just flung it all in the back. And I think they said, see you at Heathrow in 5 weeks' time. And off I went. Or I had a trip to Ely. They did squeeze in a trip to Ely. I had to go up again, because there was about, this is October, probably mid to late October time, and we didn't fly to the Falklands until just before Christmas.
What happens at Ely?
Oh, well, that RAF Ely had a very sophisticated and up-to-the-mark dental section, hospital, an RAF hospital. And I got all my teeth fixed up by the local dentist. And then I had to go to Ely to get the teeth checked off. And bizarre operation, really. But anyway, they said...
What was bizarre about it?
Well, because they just whisked me in, and they had this huge scanner, which would... they could take a whole scan of your head. So... they did this, and of course this is something that the normal dentist of that time couldn't possibly dream about. Mm. And it showed that in one place in my jaw I had a gap in my teeth, and there was a tooth sat down in the jaw. And it also showed that I had wisdom teeth in the top, but not in the bottom. So this RAF surgeon said, we'll whip them out a minute. I said, whoa, hang on. No, you're not. We're not whipping anything out unless I know it's going to be fairly painless. At any rate, we did a degree of bartering about it, and they said, well, we'll leave the tooth that's staying in the jaw. We'll leave that one. That could be tricky. We'll leave that, but we will pull your wisdom teeth out. So he said, they'll come out dead easy. He said the only reason we're taking them out, he said, is because there's no lower ones. There's nothing for them to work on. It's a waste of time. They will get, they may suffer from decay or whatever, so we'll just whip them out. It was part of the, if you don't need it, whip it out syndrome that Bass used to have in those days. I mean, they nearly would take your appendix out if they thought it was half a chance. So they took these wisdom teeth out, kicked me out the door and said, yeah, you'll be all right. And I can remember thinking, bloody hell, my face is a bit numb, you know. But anyway, I'd made arrangements to go and visit a friend of mine who lived in North London for the night. So I drove back down the A11 and all that, back down towards London. I was somewhere in Hertfordshire, and I thought, well, I better get some petrol. So I drove into this little old petrol station, which was actually served. You know, an old lady came out, tottering out, asked me what I wanted. And when I went to speak, it was just... She must have thought I was simple, because I couldn't speak properly. And anyway, we duly sorted it out. By the time I got to London, I regained the power of speech. But, that was quite a... I think actually the RAF dentist, who was really a character, and he first of all, he complimented my dentist, my local dentist, on the standard of work that he'd done. And he had obviously made a very good job of things, because here we are, nearly bloody 30 years or 30 odd years later, and the work has never been touched. It's remained. So he did a very good job, and the RAF dentist said that. And also, the RAF dentist had a mouth full of fillings. Physician, heal thyself.
And it didn't hurt when the anaesthetic wore off. Was there any other medical testing?
No.
Into a medical generally?
Not that I recall, but I suspect they probably did. And I suspect they probably also drew blood. Mm. Bass have had a long and fine tradition of drawing blood.
But you got the job before the medical, which is interesting.
Yeah. Obviously, they thought that as long as I could walk up the stairs and get into the office, that was good enough.
And crawl under a tractor.
Exactly.
Yeah. What was the money like? Was it better than Libya?
No, but the advantage was that you didn't pay UK income tax. So... I didn't do the Bass job for the money.
No, very few people do.
No, it was useful at the end, but I didn't do it for the money. The MF job, because of, I have to be careful what I say, but because of, shall we say, the Arab world, it needs to be a bit more than just interesting. Whereas the Bass job, I can't even remember what it was now. It might have been no more than a couple of £1,000 a year. I can't remember, but it wasn't very much money.
So you had about 4 weeks then to put your life in order.
Yeah, not long. But it didn't really matter in those days, you see, because somewhat of a simplification, but I could nearly carry my worldly possessions on my back. You know, I didn't really have anything much. And the bits and pieces
wife.
I did... No, God, no. I didn't really have very much. And the bits that I had were stored away. Either one or two of the bigger things were stored at friends' farms, and the rest of the stuff was at my parents' house. So there really wasn't anything very much.
But did you... Was there any training? Did you do the crevasse training or the health and safety?
No, but people didn't in those days. Not much. I mean, they did. I missed, obviously, Cambridge conference had been weeks and weeks before, back in September time. So, you know, I arrived on the scene long after all that. And even then, I think Cambridge conference in those days was a fairly simplistic affair. basically sat in a room watching slides and listening to people talk at you.
It's a bit more serious now.
Far more serious now, yeah. It's much more finger waving now.
Mm.
Yeah.
But how do you... this all happened very suddenly, and suddenly, and I presume you were signing up for 2.5 years.
No, I didn't. They would like me to have done, but they accepted that because it all happened so quickly that they would allow me a one winter contract, which was pretty unusual. But it was, I was able to go south with practically no possessions of my own because these bloody great kit bags took up all the weight. You know, there really wasn't. I had a backpack, and that was my personal goods. So no, I went for one winter to Halley, and then midway through they asked me if I wanted to do a second one there, but that's somewhat jumping the gun. But no, I went for 18 months.
Okay, but that in that period between passing the medical and getting the job and arriving at Heathrow, what sort of things were you doing? Were you just having a holiday?
No. wherever I've been, I just kept working. I worked for a John Deere dealer in Devizes then, and I had a number of things of my own to sort out. So I can't remember how long I worked with them for, but certainly by the time October came around, I'd given me notice and it's time to clear off and sort some of my own stuff out.
Where did you fly to?
Buenos Aires.
Did you pick up the boat there?
No, we then flew down. In the old days, you used to have what they call a white card, which was issued by the Argentine consulate in London. And you had to have this white card to fly to the Falklands. So we flew from Heathrow to Buenos Aires, and we had a night in Buenos Aires. And then we flew down to Comodoro Rivadavia, which is in southern Argentina, Gulf of San Jorge. And then the following day, we then flew across on an F-27 to the Falklands. I can remember being absolutely bowled over by Buenos Aires. I mean, it was something different. I'd never experienced anything like it. It was anarchic and great fun. They put us up in the City Hotel, and there was quite a number of us. They'd obviously had some sort of catastrophic problem with recruitment, because I flew south with three people that I wintered with. Andy Green, the radio operator, who was seconded from the RAF. Pat Cooper, who was an electronics guy. He was seconded from the Army. And the other guy, who I'm desperately trying to think of his name, he lives in Andover. He was seconded from the RAF as well. And they were beastie men. And we all flew down together, along with one or two others. And it was huge fun, really. huge fun. We probably don't want to go into too many of the details of the Argentinian side of the trip, but it was a lot of fun.
Beyond the scope of this interview.
I think it's probably well beyond the scope of it, yeah. But it was a lot of fun. Huge fun. And the Argentinians were absolutely paranoid that we may see any of their oil installations that were in Comodoro. And they practically blindfolded us to get on the aircraft. You know, the security was absurd. And they made us pull all the windows shutters down in this aircraft before it took off. And just as, you know, it was in such a ropey condition that when it actually was going down the runway, these blackouts were falling out of the windows. So, you know, we could look across the sea at all anyway. And I can remember it was a three-hour flight from Comodoro across to Stanley. It was three and a half hours. And the pilot never managed to synchronise the engines the entire distance. All you could hear was wah, 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 as the engines were out of sync. You know, it was just awful. And then Stanley. What a difference. Stanley was a funny place in 1978.
Still is, apparently.
What was funny? Nothing like it was.
What was funny about it from your point of view?
Well, it was... You had this, you had England, Britain, 8,000 miles away. And you just didn't expect it.
8,000 miles and 2 or 3 decades away.
Mm, yeah. Oh, 2 or 3 decades for sure.
Yeah.
And it was a very insular place in those days. And, you know, Basque people were given large amount of tolerance, really, because Basque was seen as an important part, not just of the Falklands, but of that whole area, you know, and the ships are registered in the Falklands, and the whole thing, you know, was very, very pro-Basque. So you could be a naughty boy and still pretty much get away with it. But it was quite an experience, and I mean, in those days there was no road out of Stanley. Once you got to the edge of Stanley, that was pretty much it. You know, it was just tracks, and we waited for the ship. For we had about 2 weeks there, I think, waiting for the ship, waiting for Bransfield, and we walked all over the place and explored, and it was great, and. Probably we stayed in the Upland Goose Hotel, and which was unusual, but there was nowhere else, I suppose. And I can remember being in the bar one night, just before Christmas, might have been Christmas Eve even, and this drunk burst through the doors, and have a drink, boys. So we had a drink, have another drink, boys, and this went on for some while, and eventually collapsed in a heap. But we noticed every time he had these Falkland Island banknotes, and he's pointing at them, but he was so incoherent, we didn't understand what he was saying. He kept pointing at these notes, you see, and eventually he collapsed, and Des King, that ran the Upland Goose in those days, Des came out and dragged him round the back, and the evening carried on. And I said to Des, I said, who was that, Des? I said, he kept pointing at the banknotes. Oh, yeah, 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 he said he would do. He said he's a treasurer of the Falkland Islands. He said he only comes out a couple of times a year. He does like to enjoy himself.
Fascinating.
So you're drinking government beer?
yes, I suppose indirectly we were, yeah. Everything was tinned in those days. I mean, you know, McEwen's Extra, I think, was the main drink. Mucky Jock.
You were only 3 years before the Falklands War when you were passing through the Falklands. Was there any sense of antagonism?
Not really, not at that time, because, I mean, the Argentinians were making life as difficult as possible for the Falklanders. All this white card nonsense. All this restriction on travel, you know, they were making it as difficult as they reasonably could. But there was no real sign of any aggression at that point.
Right.
No.
You've obviously been told you were going to Halley.
Yeah.
Did you have any concept what Halley was and where it was like? Did you know you were going to be living underground?
I think I did know that, but the details were very sketchy. I'd seen virtually no photographs of it. I knew practically nothing about it, really, other than that there was a hell of a lot of snow everywhere and they had an international bulldozer and you lived underground. But apart from that, No, not much really.
So what were your early impressions of the place when you finally got there?
Well, I don't know. It wasn't that straightforward because, first of all, you see, we went via South Georgia. And my first recollection, really, of the Antarctic or sub-Antarctic was waking up on a Sunday morning. It was flat calm, which is bloody unusual for that part of the world, and looking out the porthole and seeing South Georgia in sunshine with no clouds, cloudless sky, and I just... You know, you do a double take because you just cannot believe what it looks like. And so it's a progressive thing, really. And then, of course, you have the sea ice, you know, crashing through the sea ice. Well, I remember seeing that. That reminds me. I saw, when I was at junior school, a story about the supply ship Magadan. And I just remembered. I can remember seeing there was film footage of the Magadan crashing through sea ice, and I just remembered this. So it's a progressive thing, really. And the day we got to Halley, it had mank, you know, it was overcast. So there was no real depth of field. There was no, very, very difficult to tell what was up and what was down, really. So it was a progressive thing, really, and there was so much going on because the ship in those days dumped the cargo, took the people that were going home on, and that was it, and it was done. And if they could do it in 3 days, they did it in 3 days. So it was a very, very frantic few days, and... you just think, what the hell's going on? You know, what is it all about? So it took a while to sink in, really. There's so much going on, really. It was only probably once the ship had left that you actually started to look around and think, wow, there's a bloody lot of space here.
Was there enough space for you?
Oh, yeah. More than enough. Yeah. Great fun.
You have a gleam in your eye about the landscape at Halley.
Yeah, it never bothered me. I'm not a mountaineer or a mountain climber. I don't need necessarily to have mountains around me. Like I say, Halley actually, people think Halley's flat, but it isn't. It rolls. It's rolling country, rolling ice. So there is ups and downs, and it's just you don't necessarily always see them because of weather conditions. You're not aware that they're actually going up and down. But I don't have a problem with the view.
What were your living conditions like?
Grim.
Which hut? Which one were you in?
I was in Halley 3.
Right.
The Armco one. By the time I got there. I think I'm right in saying that Halley 3 was built in 1972. By the time I got there, it was 30-odd feet down. So getting in and out of the place was becoming quite difficult. And it was also starting to suffer badly from distortion and sinking in some parts. So it was pretty... it was pretty crude, really. In fact, it was bloody crude. And I suppose that sort of probably came as a bit of a shock, but not having actually known any different, you just took it as, this is what it was like. And it didn't really bother me. No, it didn't bother me, really. It's what you expected in a way, although some of it was perhaps a tad on the extreme side. I mean, in those days, again, Bass had no money at that time, and everything was done on a shoestring, a real shoestring. Mm. There was only two generators when there should really have been three. So blackouts at Halley 3 were a regular occurrence. The generators were running very, very close to their maximum loads, and it only needed somebody with a, you know, just to put one light extra on, and that was it. It tripped it all out. So consequently, of course, none of the pit rooms were heated. The whole pit room block was unheated. So you'd record minus 12 degrees in the winter months in your pit room. I mean, you didn't mess around in your pit room, and you certainly didn't spend any time in there. The lounge was only heated from Friday night to Sunday night. It wasn't heated the rest of the time, so that got cold as well. Though, because it was in the living block with the kitchen, it did get some heat from the kitchen, so it didn't get really, really cold. But you wouldn't have wanted to go and sit in there. It was a fairly austere sort of a place.
If you couldn't sit in your bunk room or pit room, and you couldn't sit in the lounge Monday to Friday, Monday to Thursday, what did they do with yourself?
Actually, we did put the heating on Wednesdays because we had a film show on Wednesdays. Oh, well, you either work dining room or the I had a little office in the workshop, tractor shop, and I was lucky that I actually had a heater in there, but quite a lot of the place was unheated because all the power was needed to keep the Wolf 2 radar heated to enable the Met balloons to be followed. So we were slaves to the radar, really.
Mm. One of the drawbacks of the decay, how the base was decaying, was the voids between the huts and the Armco.
Yeah, they had been neglected for some years.
So what was the problem there?
Well, essentially condensation. The ice built up, partly due to principally due to condensation, I suppose. And the ice was building up between the Armco steel tube and the wooden buildings, and it was starting to push the buildings in. Also, the floor of the Armco was starting to come up in the centre. The pressure on it was so much, it was starting to come up in the centre. So the buildings were all on a tilt and all over the place. And Pete Whitty decided, and rightly so, that this ice had to be cleared out. And the everybody was involved in it. And there was hundreds of tons of ice removed from around timber buildings. And Jack Scotcher, who was our carpenter, Jack was much, much more than a carpenter. He was a true... he was a joiner. He had, before he came south, made wheels for wagons and restored carriages and all sorts of things. A very, very clever man. And he rejacked and rejigged all the buildings within the Armco. And he spent a long time doing it, but the effect of it was dramatic. And then once he got them back on a level keel again, we then pretty much redecorated the place. And the following year, when Bransfield came back, when Eric Salmon and Dad came down, they couldn't believe the difference. It was like a different base. Huge amount of work went into it, but it extended the life of Halley 3 by probably 5 years.
Just talk a bit about the process of getting this ice out of the voids.
It was chipped out by hand.
Coal mining, was it?
Coal mining, ice mining. It was chipped out with mattocks and loaded into drums. The drums were wheeled round to the gas shaft and then lifted out and taken away to the dump and got rid of. And there was just, it was a, I can't remember exactly, but we certainly took a sledge load of ice out every week, and probably two.
Unpopular work?
No, I don't know that it was unpopular, because everybody realised it had to be done. So you just did it. The main area that was done was the actual living area. Jack did a bit of work in the pit room block, but that was beyond redemption, really. That was starting to get past the point of being able to do anything with it at all.
For somebody who likes wide open spaces and views of the countryside from your windows, how was it living underground? Did it feel claustrophobic at all? Were you worried about the creaks and the groans?
No, it didn't bother me much. No. Okay. You don't actually... I never really made a connection with it particularly. And one of the advantages of it, in some respects, is when you went down your hole, then you left the Antarctic behind. Oh, that's not actually right. That's not quite right. But there was you had this difference, you know, where when you were up on the top, you were in the wind and the weathers, and you knew what was going on. But when you were downstairs, you didn't really.
Different country. Tell me a bit about Pete Whitty. He was your base commander, and I wonder what your relationship with Pete was like.
Pete, I think, Pete had been at Halley before, and he'd been involved in the vehicle side of things with Honk Davis the winter before, or 2 winters before I went in. And I think Pete thought that he was just going to carry on and as he was, but I had some fairly... I wouldn't say strong views about things, but certainly I was my own man. I always have been. And in the first few months, it took us a little while to sort out that I actually knew as much about any of the vehicles as he did, and probably more, because that had been my background. So, there was a certain... I wouldn't say treading on toes, but it took us a little while to get ourselves organised. Mutually organised, which we did do, and then we got on quite well. But it took a little while. Did take a little while.
What sort of problems did the technology, the mechanical technology, present you with? I mean, it's one thing servicing an international harvester in a garage in Wiltshire, and another possibly in the temperatures of the Antarctic.
Yeah, dramatically different. It did pose some... it did pose some interesting problems, but I've always... generally, I've always risen to a challenge. I try to, anyway. And I enjoyed it, really, because it was... There's two aspects to it, really. One is the job out there was what you made it. If you wanted to make a job of it, then there was huge scope. And I love the freedom of it. I love the freedom to make my own mind up about how I was going to do something or what I was going to do, and the way that I would do it. And it was great. And fortunately, my background... certainly with the agricultural contractor, was, you know, I wouldn't say make, do and mend, but you engineered your way out of things. You know, you had to make a decision. You're in a field or you're miles from anywhere or whatever, and you do the best you can and you made it work. And that's really what Bass wanted. And I enjoyed that aspect of it. I really did. That was one of the big pluses of the job, really, that, you know, it's yours, boy, get on with it.
So were you solving problems with FIDS bodge, or were you machining perfect parts in your workshop?
A combination, really. Yeah, I mean both. We had a lot of spare parts for the bulldozer, but Snowcat spares were relatively few and far between, and you have to do the best you can. So sometimes you did a fid bodge, but if you could do something a bit better, or you had the ability to do something a bit better, then you did it a bit better. Horses for courses, really.
So you had the resources, you had the workshop, you had metal parts, you had raw materials to make things.
Yeah, quite good, really. There was, in those days, there was a few important items lacking. And probably also, I wanted to do more than probably the job had previously had done. For instance, all this ice mining meant that we had to lift an awful lot of stuff up and down the shafts. And the problem with the shafts at that time was they had a very rickety gantry affair on the edge of them, which was bloody deadly. It required somebody to operate this gantry standing on the top of an open shaft. And then pulling the rope up with either the muskeg or the international dozer. Well, if the visibility was poor, by the time you got to the end of the piece of rope, you couldn't see what the bloke at the top of the shaft was telling you. You know, if it was snowy or blowy, so bloody dangerous, really. And Pete rightly said, we've got to improve on this. So I made a very rudimentary crane to go on the back of the muskeg and use a muskeg winch. And we pulled tons and tons and dozens of drums out with this thing, because the guy that was operating the winch, the crane, stood beside the machine and he could see everything that was going on. So it reduced the risk of not so much dropping drums of ice back down the shaft, but dropping the honey buckets back down the shaft, which was a pretty much a mortal sin.
Right. And you made it out of spare parts?
No, I made it out of bits and pieces that we picked up at South Georgia. Me and Pete Whitty went on the Lurick at South Georgia and picked up all sorts of bits of steel, tubes and plates. And
on the way in?
Yeah.
So this was already a plan?
I don't know as it go as far as to say a plan, but Pete knew, I think, probably, that there was not too much in the way of materials at Halley and wanted to do something about it. So we looked all sorts of stuff out.
What kind of problems did the International Harvest present you with then? Anything out of the ordinary?
Well, the principal difficulty, of course, is getting the things to start. but I did develop a process, and I did generally get it to go down to minus 30. After minus 30, then it got incredibly difficult and extremely time-consuming. To get it to go up minus 30 probably took the better part of a day. But I got it better than that, but there was a process that you had to adhere to, and organisation. You had to be prepared. When you shut the machine down, when you've been using it, you had to shut it down and then leave it in a position where it was ready to go. If you didn't do that, it wouldn't go. It was... Getting it to go was the first problem, really. Once you got it going and warm through and usable, the second problem really was actually seeing what you were doing. It had cabs that had been made by, I think they were either made by Cabcraft or Retford Sheet Metal, one or the other, and they had tiny windows in, and the visibility was absolutely awful. And in those old crawlers, they were completely manually operated. There was no power shift, there was no automatic transmission or anything like that. and you were like a one-armed paper hanger actually driving it, because you had, you needed both hands for steering, for the clutch and brakes, well, both feet for steering on the brakes, both hands to steer the clutches. But you also had to have another arm to operate the blade. So you were pretty busy inside. And in poor weather, it was difficult to see out of it, partly because the windows froze over because there was no heater in the cab. Well, I say there was no heater. There was no heater connected to the engine cooling system. There was a Webasto kerosene burning heater, but they were bloody useless and unreliable. So it was, you got used to driving it, looking through a 6-inch hole in the windscreen.
Was there anything you could do about that?
Well, we tried a number of things about, you know, getting copper tubing and making vents in the top to blow air up on the screen. But they will work when, frankly, they will work when you didn't need them, because they weren't powerful enough to actually have any real heating effect when the wind was up. You know, in 30 knots of wind, it would just whisk all the heat out the cab immediately, you know. So, yeah, keeping... if we had to keep the garage ramp open for a particular reason and it blew, then it was quite a demanding job, really. Especially if it was dark with limited lights, limited vision because of the ice in the cab. It was quite difficult, really quite a challenge.
So whilst you were watching all this struggle, were you forming a plan or recommendation for future years?
Oh, absolutely. I've never been short of ideas.
So and what were your recommendations to Bass about these harvesters?
Well, I have to go back and look in my annual report that I did, which I haven't done.
Off the top of your head.
I knew that it was the last year for that old machine, because I knew that there was a new machine coming in the next relief, which had a power shift transmission, which was with just a forward and reverse shuttle. So you just had fingers really to make it go backwards and forwards, which is a huge improvement. So I knew that improvement was on the way. I think probably I had ideas about heating them up, preheating them to get them to start. But that was probably about all. Like I say, I knew that a new machine was in the offing.
So you were just seeing the old machine out, basically?
Yep.
Best you could.
Yeah.
And was there a temptation once you got it started to just leave it running overnight?
No, I didn't. I did do that on some occasions, but I didn't like doing it because to leave an engine running unattended is not good policy. We did in extremis, we used to do it, and it was part of the night watchman's duties to go up there every hour and make sure it was still running. But no, I only did that in extremis. It's
so
a good way of ruining them.
Sorry?
Good way of ruining them.
What would be an extreme enough situation to make you want to keep it running?
Well, if we had to do all the food in those days, except for some of the meat, was all out on dumps. It was all outside, all out on dumps. So if we had a run the following day planned to go and get food off the dumps, then that would have been a good reason.
Right. Okay. What about the snowcats and the skidoos? Were they also troublesome, or were they...
Yeah, the snowcats had their problems. We had two. We had a large one, which was actually pretty good, and then we had a small one, which was really too small to be of any use. Both had problems. Both we had to basically manufacture parts for. But they were good. We didn't use them hugely because we had the old Muskeg.
Mm.
Muskeg was fairly bomb-proof, really. certainly fairly fid-proof, whereas snowcats were not quite so accommodating. Snowmobiles were a nightmare. They were all pretty much worn out or unsuitable. And were the bane of my life. When I first got there, I was doing a recoil starter, because I didn't have electric starters in those days. I was doing doing the rope in a recoil starter every day. And we had about 6 or 8 snowmobiles that I used all the time. And one or two of the lads just, they didn't understand that when you came to the end of the rope, you had to stop. But they just, and there'd be these snowmobile skidoos abandoned all over the Bondi with no bloody recoil starter in them. So I put it for a while, and I can remember probably, I don't know, February, March time, I think I probably, March, probably, I'd had enough of this. And I made a decree in the dining room one day, and I said, I am only going to do recoil starters every other week. So if you break one this week, it will be the end of next week before I get round to it. And I never did any more after that. Rarely ever. So it did work. But snowmobiles in those days were frankly rubbish.
Snowmobile's another word for Skidoo, is it?
Skidoo. Skidoo is a brand name.
Right.
We had Skidoos, and we had some Mercury snowmobiles. The Mercs were made by the same people that make Mercury outboards. Beautifully made, wonderfully designed, but completely unsuitable. I don't know why Bass bought them, really. One of the great mysteries. They were fantastic and huge fun, and I kept them under lock and key most of the time because people could have seriously injured themselves with them. 70 mile an hour was not a problem.
Rumour has it you used to hide all the keys on New Year's Eve as well.
No, I never did that. I don't think so, anyway. I would like to think that I had sufficient respect that they wouldn't go doing that anyway. I don't think I ever did it.
There's something about a blow-up summer garage and
yes.
And a collision with Al Smith, big Al Smith.
When we built Halley 5, it was a major undertaking, an absolute massive undertaking. And I felt that we had to have somewhere to keep the vehicle spares and to be able to work on the vehicles during the course of the building project. And I sort of hummed and hawed about all sorts of things, but I spoke with a guy, I think he was up in Nottinghamshire, and about this inflatable tent. And cut a very long story short, he said that he could make an inflatable tent that would work during the summer season at Halley. Mm. And we had a few modifications done to it. We had some big tie-downs sewn into it. But it was a big structure. I mean, we could put one of the Nodwell crawler machines in it. And it was, it stood out. You could see it for miles. It was red and white striped. Again, I wanted it to stand out so you could see it. So we had it red and white striped, and it was a huge thing. And it had a fan that ran continuously to keep it inflated. And the difference it made for the mechanics was, it didn't have any wind in it. You know, it was calm. It was cold. It even warmed up inside because the sun used to warm the thing up. In fact, one of the problems we suffered from with it was that it used to ablate the floor inside it. So gradually, as the summer went on, the floor got lower and lower and lower. But it was a great thing. And but its downside was it needed this fan to run all the time. and also rolling it up, letting it down and rolling it up was quite a procedure because it weighed well over a ton when it was all rolled up and put in its box. It weighed over a ton. And Smithy was... Smithy had a pre-production Bombardier Skidoo, an Alpine 2, and it was a huge thing, a great, great big Skidoo, and painted black. And Smithy had a black weather suit, you know, snow suit. And he had a black helmet as well. And he looked like Darth Vader sat on this thing. It's great. But Al's not terribly nimble, really. Nimble is not one of Al's strong points. And one day he went to start this Skidoo up. It fired up and somehow he fell over. Opened the throttle up. And this thing shot across the bonneet straight to the side of this tent, made a huge hole in the side of it. And, of course, it just collapsed around it, you know. And that was a... we brought it home that year and had it sewn back up again. But it didn't do much damage. But, of course, as soon as the air had gone, down it came. But it was a great tent. Brilliant idea.
Did it survive many seasons?
We used it for... we used it all the time, every season, until we actually built the movable garage. So it did three or four seasons.
On a much smaller scale, there's a story about a Weatherhaven tent being pitched or being used under the snow.
Yeah, they weren't quite so robust. They were okay, but they were pretty flimsy, really. And one of them did collapse. We let the snow get too far up it. I think the winter snow did for it, and it collapsed it.
Anybody inside?
No. But getting the stuff out, well, it was a food tent, and getting all the stuff out from inside it was a bloody nightmare.
Once one had collapsed, did that affect the way you viewed them in the future?
No, not really.
So you still use them?
They were being used outside of their working parameter, really. They were never meant to be allowed to have snow build up around them to the extent that happened at Halley. What they should have done, but you couldn't because of logistical reasons, was to take them apart and store them again and put them together the following year, but that wasn't going to work. So... No, it wasn't the tent's fault. It was purely what they were being used for and the position they were being used.
And there was a snowblower that you had at Halley as well, I believe.
Well, we had two. The first one, I didn't have anything to do with the purchase of. I think Paul Whiteman bought it from Rolba, and that was on tracks. It was a hugely complicated piece of equipment and had the ability to dig big trenches, but unfortunately didn't have the ability to get itself back out of them. we dug these big trenches to put the foundations for Halley 5 in. Bloody great holes. And it did that, and it did it very well, but like I say, it couldn't really get itself about. The tracks had been made to work in alpine passes. So wet snow, compacted, it was fine. And if it was on a road or whatever, it didn't carve the road up. But as soon as you broke through the crust at Halley, you were into this sugar. And it couldn't handle that. So it really struggled to get itself about, really. And it was also... a very, very fickle beast. It had some very, very fine adjustments to make it work. The upside of it was I got a trip to Switzerland to find out how to drive it. but it had problems. So at that time, Bass was awash with money. Maggie Thatcher had poured money, or was pouring money, into Bass. And we bought, because International Harvester were no longer in business, we bought Caterpillar D4H low ground pressure bulldozers. We fitted them up with Basto heating equipment, so you could start them at minus 30 without any grief at all. And one of those, I bought two snowblowers, one for Rothera, which went on the front of the articulated loader that was at Rothera, and the other one we took apart, took in half. We made a quick hitch attachment that clipped over the top of the Caterpillar blade for the front cutting part. And then we made linkage for the rear part, for the power pack, engine and pumps and what have you. And that went on the back of the Caterpillar. So we fetched up with a tracked snowblower, but in a completely different way. I suppose in terms of cost, I expect the machine cost something in the order of, somewhere between £150,000 and £170,000. A serious amount of money. But it did what it said on the label. And the third season into Halley 5, we had to... there was problems with the water melter. Basically, the water melter didn't work, and it had to come out, and they had to put a new one in. But by then, it was 8 or 9 meters deep. So I sat on this snowblower that we'd built, and I dug a hole 9 meters deep. But it wasn't just 9 meters deep; it was the whole size of the hole was just unbelievable.
A crater.
It was a crater. And fortunately, we had about 4 or 5 weeks perfect weather. It was a perfect weather season. And I dug this massive hole, and we managed to get this new water melter, which was a pretty sizable affair, down into this hole and into the Armco shaft of Halley 5, and got it all working again.
We've drifted into your period when you were in working for Bass on a regular basis, late in the 1980s and beyond. But one of the problems with snow blowers was they didn't just blow snow, they blew anything they found in their path.
Yeah, you kept out of the way of them. I think Bass chippies have always had a tradition that you bang one nail in and you throw another nail on the floor. And you keep out of the way of them. Yeah, when they're working, you don't get anywhere near them at all.
But you're finding bigger things than nails. You're finding spades and Kit Kats.
Oh, yeah.
Tins of food.
All sorts of things. Shovels would go up the spout from time to time.
Let's pause, and we'll come back and talk some more.
Yep.